I did not record with the cloud. I assume it actually works better. You get the feedback? I got my probably for this computer right here. Feel like that. Let's stop it. Blinking.
It's refrigerated. I don't use refrigerated.
So I'll have two or three minutes of dead. Who's that? I had a dream about latch license. Hey, Lutch.
Hi, how are you?
Hey, Lutch.
Good. You
Good.
invaded my psyche last night, Lutch. I don't know why.
What?
You invaded my psyche last night. I had a dream about you leaving for some reason.
Oh, really?
Really weird. Okay, let's get started, everybody. Everything's going now. This is Dr. Roger Paul, and tonight we are going to continue our study on the paper 130, Jesus Going to Rome. And we're in section two, paragraph three, and that's on the paper 130 of the other books. And the original book is 1430, page 1430.1. Let me get my breath here. Dear, would you stop moving? Oh, sorry. I got the opening screen up. Y'all like that screen I created? It's
Yeah,
small.
it's pretty cool.
Pretty good. Shut it. And half AI, half me. Where did you close it?
There is quite a bit of echoing, Roger.
Yes, there
Ooh,
is.
it's trying to figure out where it's coming from.
Is that
Oh.
like an echo?
Can they hear you?
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay, good. All right, much better. Thank you. All right. While the Eastern branch of the early Christian church, having its headquarters at Philadelphia, held more faithfully to the teachings of Jesus than did the Jerusalem brethren, it was regrettable that there was no one like Peter to go into China or like Paul to enter India, where the spiritual soil was then so favorable for planting the seed of the new gospel of the kingdom. These very teachings of Jesus, as they were held by the Philadelphians, would have made just such an immediate and effective appeal to the minds of the spiritually hungry, ascetic people as did the preaching of Peter and Paul in the West.
Makes you what wonder whatever became of the Eastern teachings. Roger, you're muted.
There we go. We found out from previous studies that Philadelphia was a lot more along the line of Jesus's teachings, right? And it stayed that way probably until the Catholic Church came in at about 300 and whenever it was, 90 something, 60, 70 or 90 something, when they developed the New Testament. But since obviously, there wasn't anyone in the Philadelphia church that was strong enough to keep teaching and go into India. Paul's gospel ended up winning out over everybody else's, even Peter's. So, but it would have been interesting if the gospel, according to what they taught at Philadelphia, had stayed. We would be more along the line of what Jesus really taught us to believe, right? The fatherhood of God and the brotherhood of man. So it's interesting how one person like Paul can come along and change the direction of the church. You know what I mean? So it's real interesting. And there was not really anyone to teach the Asiatic peoples like Paul did in the West. So it would have been very beneficial because all the Indian people would have had a gospel taught to them, right? All right, let's see here. I want to go to Jane next. Jane, can you read that red okay?
No, I cannot read it.
Mm. All right, let me go back up here. Let me change color on it. Let me see if I can change the color on it real quick. Give me 1 second.
Right now, it's better.
Okay.
Yeah, but he advanced it.
I advanced it. How's that?
That's much
okay.
Better.
I can try. I can try, yeah.
Is
so
that
there is the white and yellow, both of them. Is that one paragraph?
Yes, that's one paragraph. The yellow is the words of Jesus. I just took them out and read.
Okie dokie. Okay. I might have to do it a bit slowly because I'm on my cell phone. That's why.
Oh, okay. You want to wait and take another one that's not this small?
Yes, that's a very good idea. Thank you.
Okay. Roger, I just logged in and I was late. You want me to do it as penance?
Yeah, that's well. I'll take it, and then Jane can take the next one. We'll come back around. As one of the young men who worked with Jesus one day on the steering paddle became much interested in the words which he dropped from hour to hour as they toiled in the shipyard. When Jesus intimated that the Father in heaven was interested in the welfare of his children on earth, this young Greek, Anaxan, said, "If the gods are interested in me, why do they not remove the cruel and unjust foreman of this workshop?" He was startled when Jesus replied, excuse me, "Since you know the ways of kindness and the value justice, perhaps the gods have brought this erring man near you that you may lead him into the better way. Maybe you are the salt which is to make this brother more agreeable to all other men. That is, if you have not lost your savor. As it is, this man is your master in that his evil ways unfavorably influenced you. Why not assert your mastery of evil by virtue of the power of goodness and thus become the master of all relations between the two of you? I predict that the good in you could overcome the evil in him if you gave it a fair and living chance. There is no adventure in the course of mortal existence more enthralling than to enjoy the exhilaration of becoming the material life partner with spiritual energy and divine truth in one of their triumphant struggles with error and evil. This is marvelous and transforming experience to become the living channel of spiritual light to the mortal who sits in spiritual darkness. If you are more blessed with truth than is this man, his need should challenge you. Surely you are not the coward who could stand by on the seashore and watch a fellow man who could not swim perish. How much more of value is this man's soul floundering in darkness compared to his body drowning in water?"
Wow.
Boy, is that not deep?
It's profound.
It says it. Says it well. I was working on, I'm rewriting six of the chapters of the book I just finished, to let y'all know. I was not happy with 4 and 5, so I rewrote both of those today, and I don't remember if it was in 4 or 5, but chapter 4, chapter 5 goes over the difference between evil and sin, and this is a perfect example of what they're talking about here, the fact that evil is not equal to good. There's not any comparison at all. Evil is there in our life for us to learn lessons and advance spiritually along the way. It's our experiential partner. When we run into evil, it gives us the opportunity to choose good and truth. So this is what Jesus was talking about here, right? If this man would allow the truth to come through him in his spiritual enlightenment, then this evil man would cave in and have nothing to say about it. So, kind of interesting. Okay. Who would be next now? Jane, would you like to try this one?
Yeah, I think I can.
Okay.
Anaxand was mightily moved by Jesus' words. Presently, he told his superior what Jesus had said, and that night they both sought Jesus' advice as to the welfare of their souls. And later on, after the Christian message had been proclaimed in Caesarea, both of these men, one a Greek and the other a Roman, believed Philip's preaching and became prominent members of the church which he founded. Later, this young Greek was appointed the steward of a Roman centurion, Cornelius, who became a believer through Peter's ministry. Anaxand continued to minister light to those who sat in darkness until the days of Paul's imprisonment at Caesarea, when he perished by accident in the great slaughter of 20,000 Jews while he ministered to the suffering and dying.
That's amazing. They slaughtered 20,000 Jews at Caesarea, and it's not even mentioned anywhere, even in the Bible, as far as I know. So that's not good. So this little talk Jesus had with this young man did a lot of good. He, you know, changed his life. And this is believed to be where Paul preached there at the stand. All right. There's appeal to Caesar. This is when Paul made the appeal to Caesar that he was a Roman citizen. All right. We just went past the paragraph. Let me change the color again for y'all.
I can read it.
Can you read it okay?
Yes.
Go ahead, Bobby.
Okay. And it was, by this time, beginning to learn how his tutor spent his leisure in this unusual personal ministry to his fellow men. And the young Indian set about to find out the motive for these incessant activities. He asked, "Why do you occupy yourself so continuously with these visits with strangers?" And Jesus answered, "Kened, no man is a stranger to one who knows God. In the experience of finding the Father in heaven, you discover that all men are your brothers. And does it seem strange that one should enjoy the exhilaration of meeting a newly discovered brother? To become acquainted with one's brothers and sisters, to know their problems, and to learn to love them, is the supreme experience of living."
And this ties right back into the fatherhood of God and the brotherhood of man, doesn't it?
That's right.
Learning to love one another, all your brothers and sisters. Okay, Lesh, can you read that okay? And take that one?
Yeah, okay. This was a conference which lasted well into the night, in the course of which the young man requested Jesus to tell him the difference between the will of God and that human mind act of choosing, which is also called will. In substance, Jesus said, "The will of God is the way of God, partnership with the choice of God in the face of any potential alternative. To do the will of God, therefore, is the progressive experience of becoming more and more like God, and God is the source and destiny of all that is good and beautiful and true. The will of man is the way of man, the sum and substance of that which the mortal chooses to be and do. Will is the deliberate choice of a self-conscious being, which leads to decision conduct based on intelligent reflection.
Okay, here's a great key for us in this one paragraph, and that is this. We always wonder how we know to do the will of God. And, I mean, it's a big question at the time. And it tells us right here, all right? It's based on intelligent reflection as to what is moral choices or mortal choices in this case. So if you choose only that is good in your life, and only those things that are morally what you are 100% right to be truth, then you will always be doing what? The will of God. Does that make sense? So it's the choosing. It's using your will to choose the divine will. Right? And that's how you replace your will with the will of God. Straight from Jesus. Only straight from Jesus. Right. Gary, can you read this one okay?
I'll do my best, but I'll be honest with you, having trouble with my eyes, so.
Let me change the color of this. It's through to me. Give me 1 second. As easy as 1, 2, 3. Here we go. Is that a little better?
I think so. I like yellow anyway.
Okay. Better too.
That afternoon, Jesus and Ganid had both enjoyed playing with a very intelligent shepherd dog, and Ganid wanted to know whether the dog had a soul, whether it had a will. And in response to his questions, Jesus said, "The dog has a mind which can know material man, his master, but cannot know God. He is who is spirit, therefore the dog does not possess a spirit nature and cannot enjoy the spiritual experience. Dogs may have a will derived from nature and augmented by training, but such a power of mind is not a spiritual force. Neither is it comparable to the human will, in as much as it is not reflective. It is not the result of discriminating higher and mortal or moral meaning or choosing spiritual and eternal values. It is the possession of such powers of spiritual discrimination and truth choosing that makes mortal man a moral being, a creature endowed with the attributes of spiritual responsibility and the potential of eternal survival." Jesus went on to explain that it is the absence of such mental powers in the animal which makes it forever impossible for the animal world to develop a language in time or to experience anything equivalent to personality, survival, and eternity. As a result of this day's instruction, Ganid never again entertained belief in the
migration.
Thank you. Of the soul of man into the bodies of animals.
Okay, speaking of this, I was sitting there with my wife last night watching some YouTube videos, and there's this big surge on YouTube about reincarnation again for some reason. I don't know why. But we know that reincarnation does not happen, right? And what he's talking about here is the Indians back then believed that human beings would reincarnate many times into animals. And that's why they wouldn't kill certain animals too. Okay. It was in their philosophy. But what I want to bring out here too is I worked on a paper yesterday was talking about the ideas of what animals do feel. Okay, animals feel love just like we do. They feel attachment to their children just like we do. You know, all the things that we feel, they feel also. They love for one another in the sense that they'll, you know, become friends and stay together forever, you know, especially cats and dogs and things like that. But they do not have a survival soul, and that's important. What they're talking about is a soul that can merge with the thought adjuster and go on through eternity. That is, he's not saying here that the animals all die off and nothing happens to them, is he? He's just saying they are not like human beings. They don't survive forever. But we know the local universe mother spirit's in charge of all of that. And we know there's many types of beings and animals that are reincarnated, reused again and again and again. That's my point here. Okay. So I don't want people to think that I'm saying that because animals do not have souls, that they may not reconstitute on the mansion worlds or somewhere else as animals once more. They won't reconstitute, though, as humans. Why is that? Because they don't have souls. Okay? So animals don't become humans, and humans do not become animals in any way, shape, form, or fashion, either now or in the future, as far as we know. Right? Now, we do know that some types of beings in the higher mansion worlds can earn in their lives to literally kick up a degree and that sort of thing. Just look at the cherubim. They start out as cherubim, and then if they serve properly, they can become what? Seraphim. Okay? So there's what I want you to understand here is animals, humans, and everything else, there's nothing wasted in the universe, and there's a plan for everything. Now, how is humans different from animals and other humans? A human being has a free will to choose. An animal does not. Okay? They just experience. A human has the free will to choose non-survival. You see what I'm saying? You can choose not to do the will of God, and you can choose not to survive, and you will go off into obliviousness, and your personality will never reemerge as you ever again. Okay? That's the distinction between humans and animals. Okay? All right. Questions? Comments? Roger, you're a crazy person. Okay.
I'm
Yeah.
wondering, since animals have an energy body like humans and all
Right.
plants, when they die, I'm wondering what happens to that energy when it's dissipated. Does it go to another world or another existence or?
It's, you know, it's a good question, Lutch, which I don't have the answer to. I would assume since the animals are the children of the local universe mother spirit, they are probably reconstituted as animals on the same planet or a planet similar and along the same line as the same type of animal again. You know what I'm saying? Because the mo local universe mother spirit controls that energy, and they tell us there's nothing wasted. So those creatures must be reconstituted in some way, either as the same creature again, or maybe they get reconstituted on a reconstituted. Can you talk?
Reconstituted.
Tuted.
Let me help you there, Roger. Can you help me?
Reconstituted. Maybe they go to the mansion worlds as different types of animal. I don't know. They don't tell us, right? So, but the way I have interacted with animals my whole life, with the dogs and the cats, and I've been feeding birds for some time, and all of the animals have certain tendencies, And none of them do things that you would be considered that would be considered evil. Okay, so they don't make moral choices. They're ingrained in their own psyche to survive, and they do certain things to survive. And in the wild, it seems cruel to us, but if you were in the wild and you had no other way to eat and survive, you would do the same thing the animals would. And we know that's a fact because all the early people did what?
Cannibalism.
Yeah, they ate each other. All right? That's just all there is to it. It's not a pretty sight, but they had to stay alive. And they, when they couldn't get game, that what would they resort to? They would take one of the people of the tribe and they'd kill them and eat them.
Sacrifice.
Sacrifice, right? That's how this whole sacrificial lamb stuff started, right? All right. Let's see here. Who just read? Gary? I think
Gary. Yeah.
Huh?
I believe it was me.
Okay. The next day, Gandon talked all this over with his father, and it was in answer to Gounod's question that Jesus explained that human wills, which are fully occupied with passing only upon temporal decisions having to do with the material problems of animal existence, are doomed to perish in time. Those who make wholehearted moral decisions and unqualified spiritual choices are thus progressively identified with the indwelling and divine spirit, and thereby are they increasingly transformed into the values of eternal survival, unending progression of divine service.
Okay, so if you want to survive, what do you have to do? You have to decide, right? It's a conscious choice. Nobody gets away with going through an entire life and never making a decision to just survive. Because if you did that, what would that automatically mean? That means you won't survive. Okay? And that's the important point here. That's why Jesus says here, only humans' wills which were fully occupied with temporal decisions. What's that? That's decisions of our everyday life, just about earth, having to do with the material problems of animal existence. Because if you have no, if you make no will for choices, what are you living like? You're living like an animal and you're doomed to perish in time because you're required to make a decision. Okay? And then it goes on to tell us that those who make a moral decision and qualify into spiritual choices then are identified with the divine spirit. What's the divine spirit? The infinite spirit. And as long as you're identified with the infinite spirit, you are transformed from one life to the next and eventually end up progressing in divine service through eternity because you fuse with your adjuster. Jesus makes it so clear, doesn't he?
Mm-hmm.
When he says it, it just right on the money. All right, Jane, would you take the next one, please?
Okay. It was on this same day that we first heard that monumentous truth which, stated in modern terms, would signify will is that manifestation of the human mind which enables the subjective consciousness to express itself objectively and to experience the phenomenon of aspiring to be godlike. And it is in the same sense that every reflective and spiritually minded human being can become creative.
Now, I was just teaching this morning in the video I was working on. The phenomena of aspiring to be godlike. You see where he says that? Or see where it says that right there? And what is that? That is, when you fuse, you become part of deity. You don't become divine, but you become part of deity because of the thought of justice. And that's the aspiration that we look forward to every single day, right? And it's the human will, the manifestation of the human will on the human mind that consciously expresses to be godlike. And that's how you become part of deity. You don't become deity, you become part of deity in God the Father. Right. So don't go around and tell everybody I'm going to be deity one of these days. That's not what it's saying here. Right. It's saying you'll become part of the whole of God, the I am, if you will. That's what they're talking about here. Okay. At Alexandria. Rodney, you got off this easy. I'll tell you what.
Should have been Gary's.
That's right.
So three at Alexandria. It had been an eventful visit at Caesarea. And when the boat was ready, Jesus and his two friends departed at noon one day for Alexandria in Egypt.
So Jesus helped fix the oars, and not the oars, but the controlling arm of the boat. The steering paddle. And so they were ready to go noon the next day. All right, here we go again. Letch, would you take the next one, please?
Okay. The three enjoyed a most pleasant passage to Alexandria. Ganed was delighted with the voyage and kept Jesus busy answering questions. As they approached the city's harbor, the young man was thrilled by the great lighthouse of Pharos, located on the island of Alexander, on the island which Alexander had joined by a mole to the mainland, thus creating two magnificent harbors and thereby making Alexandria the maritime commercial crossroads of Africa, Asia, and Europe. This great lighthouse was one of the seven wonders of the world and was the forerunner of all subsequent lighthouses. They arose early in the morning to view this splendid life-saving device of man, and amidst the exclamation of Ganed, Jesus said, "And you, my son, will be like the lighthouse when you return to India, even after your father is laid to rest. You will become like the light of life to those who sit about you in darkness, showing all who so desire the way to react the harbor of salvation and safety." And as Ganed squeezed Jesus's hand, he said, "I will."
So that's how all of us can become the lighthouses, right?
Yeah.
And this is a picture of a lighthouse that would have been built back then. But it's kind of interesting. If you look at this picture well, you'll see that this is probably like a 16th or 17th century ship.
Yeah.
In the background. So,
yeah.
But the lighthouse works.
Mm-hmm.
Right. All right. And this is a tapestry, I believe it is, actually showing the actual lighthouse that was at Alexandria there.
Oh.
So, it says it's a mosaic of the lighthouse and in Alexandria. So it's kind of what it looked like. All right. Gary, where'd you take this one?
Okay. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
And again, we remark that the early teachers of the Christian religion made a great mistake when they so exclusively turned their attention to the Western civilization of the Roman world. The teachings of Jesus, as they were held by the Mesopotamian believers of the first century, but have been readily received by the various groups of
Asiatic.
Thank you, religionists.
Yeah, so they would have just done some teaching in Asia during that period of time. They would have done really well. All right, we're back around. I think I'll take this one since I haven't taken one in a while. I skipped over myself last time. By the fourth hour after landing, they were settled near the eastern end of the long and broad avenue, 100 feet wide and 5 miles long. That's a big avenue, which stretched out on the western limits of the city of 1 million people. So think about this. Alexandria, and during this period of time, had 1 million people. It's a lot. After the first survey of the city's chief attractions, university, museum, library, and royal mausoleum of Alexandria, the palace, temple of Neptune, theater, and gymnasium, Gana addressed himself to business while Jesus and Gana went to the library, the greatest in the world. Here were assembled nearly 1 million manuscripts from all of the civilized world, Greece, Rome, Palestine, Parthia, India, China, and even Japan. In this library, Gana saw the largest collection of Indian literature in all the world, and they spent some time here each day throughout their stay in Alexandria. Jesus told Gana about the translation of the Hebrew scriptures into Greek at this place, and they discussed again and again all the religions of the world. Jesus endeavored to point out to these young men the truth in each, always adding, excuse me for just a second, y'all, I need to change this for my own eyes. Okay. But Yahweh is the God developed from the revelations of Melchizedek and the covenant of Abraham. The Jews were the offspring of Abraham and subsequently occupied the very land wherein Melchizedek had lived and taught, and from which he sent teachers to all the world. And their religion eventually portrayed a clear recognition of the Lord God of Israel as the universal Father in heaven than any other world religion. So he enlightened them about Melchizedek's teaching. And this is a picture. Oh, sorry, y'all. This is supposed to be a picture of the Library of Alexandria during that period of time. All right, dear, would you take the next one?
Can I ask you a question?
Yes.
Where was Melchizedek and Abram? Where was their
location wise?
Yeah.
It's where Jerusalem is. When they were there, it was called Salem. Okay. And Melchizedek teaching everyone about Jerusalem. Jerusalem is our system capital. They renamed Salem to Jerusalem. Okay. So that's how Jerusalem got its name. But that's exactly where Melchizedek and Abraham met, interact, and all that sort of thing. Abraham became the head of all the tribes there in Jerusalem. At that time, it was called Salem, but he was the head of all the tribes because he had conquered pretty much everybody. Okay.
Let me ask a question.
Sure.
Were the Palestinians there at the same time?
Yes. They were.
Okay.
Yeah, there was an intermix of people pretty much everywhere, and the main focus of Melchizedek when he was in Salem was teaching the Bedouins, okay? And the Bedouins were a group of all sorts of groups that, you know, hung out together, became put tribes together because there was strength in numbers. If you didn't have enough numbers, somebody like Abraham would have come along and wiped you out, really. That's what we're talking about. It was the stronger survived and ruled everything. Right? Okay. Let's see here. You're up.
Under Jesus' direction, Gannad made a collection of the teachings of all those religions of the world, which recognized a universal deity, even though they might also give more or less recognition to subordinate deities. After much discussion, Jesus and Gannad decided that the Romans had no real God in their religion, that their religion was hardly more than emperor worship. The Greeks, they concluded, had a philosophy, but hardly a religion with a personal God. The mystery cults they discarded because of the confusion of their multiplicity and because their varied concepts of deity seem to be derived from other and older religions.
So basically what they came up with is very few of the religions had a real God. They were all composites from other religions, multiple Godheads and things like that. And we have to be careful in teaching the Urantia book because of the structure of the deity situation in the Urantia book, having seven absolutes. We have to be careful for people to understand that when we teach that we believe in one God, the I Am, the Universal Father, that is the only one God. Everything else is within God the Father. Okay, even the Trinity and the other absolutes, they are still within one God. We don't teach monotheism of any sort. And that's what they're talking about here. Most of these religions back then were monotheistic. Speaking of, I've read so much today. Okay.
Roger, can
you
call a couple weeks back, maybe a month or two? You mentioned that in reality, you know, we believe in God the Father, the Son, and the Spirit.
Right. The Trinity.
Even though we do, we believe in God the Father is numero uno. And yeah, I forgot the exact word you used for God.
I am. It's always referred back to the I am. I am that I am.
And the other two are worshipped out of
association, really.
Association, okay.
Yeah.
Because yeah. He created them.
He created them.
But yeah. God the Father is, basically, we worship one God.
Only one God, that's right. That's correct.
And the others are the Father and the Son, like in the Christians. That's always been a hard concept. How can you have three in one?
Yeah. Because we've been taught for hundreds of years, and literally hundreds of years, since 2,000 years ago, that Jesus was a part of a Trinity, and he never was. He never corrected anybody because they did not understand what the Trinity was. You know, we forget how fortunate we are to have the Urantia book teach us all these concepts of advanced religion and philosophy that were just one big confusion before the book came out. Okay. And people still, when they first start reading the book, say, well, this is multiple gods. And no, it's not. It's multiple deities. There's a difference. Okay. The multiple deities are within God the Father, the multiple deities are the seven absolutes, with the exception of paradise and the unqualified absolute, which are not deity. Okay? But the seven absolutes are all within God the Father. So we still believe in the concept of the I am that I am. He is the universal Father, the first source of center of all, and controls still all with the association of his Son and Spirit. Okay? The other deities, the other three absolutes are really just the will of God in action, and the universal absolutes just the pathway for the will of God to deal with finite reality through the unqualified absolute. In the paradise is just the base for finite material and gravity and all the circuits. So if you think about it, everything still exists within one God, God the Father. That makes sense?
I got a question you may not wish to answer, and I respect that, which is a little bit off subject is why I say that.
It's okay. Answer your question. Ask your question.
Why do the Catholics include Mary in their worship?
Because they try to deify all their saints. They tried to sanctify, you know, it started out with just apostles, right? They tried to sanctify apostles. And early on, they tried to sanctify Jesus's mother, and Jesus never related to her in any shape, form or fashion in that way that she should be deified in any way, because she was just like every other mother who ever had a child. Just because Jesus came from her did not make her any more special than any other being. And they should never have deified her, and they shouldn't deify any of the saints either that they call saints. It's just wrong. Because number one, they have not earned it. We have not earned it. I don't care if you dedicate your whole entire life to teaching and spreading the word of God, that does not justify trying to deify you as a saint, because you did not earn it and you're not qualified for it. When we get to the mansion worlds, the first mansion worlds, we're going to see the folly of all the stuff that we did in this world. And that's going to be one of the things that it's a folly. They probably, when we get to the mansion worlds, they probably laugh at it and say, what in the heck were you thinking? You know, because the concepts and the reality of things themselves is much higher than we really can understand. That's what it boils down to.
The Catholic Church considers people that are saints that have achieved the level of being in heaven with God. But that's the human concept of heaven, and I don't think any pope or bishop or cardinal really knows what level of heaven that is, but it is supposed to signify a certain level of very high spiritual attainment close to God. Yeah. And the Virgin Mary is not a saint, but she's veneered, revered by Catholics.
Yeah, which is wrong. Jesus never told us to do that.
Right.
Ever. Yeah. The other thing I want to mention is, if these beings qualified to be saints, they should not be here. Why? Because if they qualify to be saints, they should qualify to fuse with their adjustment. Okay?
And exactly. I've never known of any saint that's fused with their adjuster.
I don't either. You know? I don't either.
Yes, we do.
Who?
Elijah.
Yeah, but they were never sanctified. Okay? Yeah. They were dead.
If you want a saint, there you go.
It was funny. I was, you know, when I was working on this book, I used, I think it was Claude, to correct some of my spelling in English. And Jane can relate to this. The reason I did that is I took the transcripts from our meetings, and I took the transcripts from our meetings. Got all the texts and stuff, and then I went through it and corrected all the stuff that I could find, and then I stuck it in Claude, which is a AI thing, and I had him go through it and correct any of them I missed. All right. Now the funny thing about that is this, and I think it was the first or second chapter. You know, and I talk about myself in the third person so that I make sure that people understand these are my concepts. These aren't the concepts of the Urantia book. Okay. Claude read it back to me. It said Saint Roger Paul instead of Dr. Roger Paul. And I thought, boy, did he miss the boat on that? Okay. Let's go on. I think we read this one. I'm trying to figure out who's next. I think Jane's next.
Yeah.
Did you just read? Didn't you just read? Yeah. Jane's next.
No, I don't think we read this.
Did we read this?
No, I don't think so.
No.
No, I don't think we did.
Thank you, Jane. I needed that backup.
Okay, shall I go ahead?
Yeah, go ahead.
Although these translations were made at Alexandria, Gannett did not finally arrange these selections and add his own personal conclusions until near the end of their sojourn in Rome. He was much surprised to discover that the best of the authors of the world's sacred literature all more or less clearly recognized the existence of an eternal God and were much in agreement with regard to his character and his relationship with mortal men.
So the most of them had a base of God the Father, then, didn't they? A concept of God the Father. Another interesting thing about this trip to Alexandria, too, is remember the Alexandrians were the ones that gave a Greek translation of the Torah to Jesus when he was a boy. Remember that?
Mm-hmm. I do.
I think that's pretty important. All right. Rodney, I think you're up. Let me change the color of this to
Okay, Jesus and Gannett spent much time in the museum during their stay in Alexandria. This museum was not a collection of rare objects, but rather a university of fine art, science, and literature. Learned professors here gave daily lectures, and in those times, this was the intellectual center of the Occidental world. Day by day, Jesus interpreted the lectures to Gannett. One day, during the second week, the young man exclaimed, "Teacher, Joshua, you know more than these professors. You should stand up and tell them the great things you have told me. They are befogged by too much thinking. I shall speak to my father and have him arrange it." Jesus smiled, saying, "You are an admiring pupil, but these teachers are not minded that you and I should instruct them. The pride of unspiritualized learning is a treacherous thing in human experience. The true teacher maintains his intellectual integrity by ever remaining a learner."
That's the number one thing, right? Always remain a learner, even if you're teaching something, right? Because you can always learn something from everyone. Okay.
Right.
I love the statement, "They are much befogged by much thinking."
Yeah. Too much thinking.
That seems to be the case nowadays, doesn't it? Okay, let's see here. I'll read this one and read the next one, dear. Alexandria was the city of the blended culture of the Occident next to Rome, the largest, most significant in the world. Here was located the largest Jewish synagogue in the world, the seat of government of Alexandria's Sanhedrin, the 70 ruling elders. So the highest people were there in Alexandria. All right, dear. Did you take the next one?
Among the many men with whom Gannett transacted business was a certain Jewish banker, Alexander, whose brother Philo was a famous religious philosopher of that time. Philo was engaged in the laudable but exceedingly difficult task of harmonizing Greek philosophy and Hebrew theology. Gannett and Jesus talked much about Philo's teachings and expected to attend some of his lectures. But throughout their stay at Alexandria, this famous Hellenistic Jew lay sick in bed.
Okay, so they were going to try to listen to some of his lectures, but he was sick in bed most of the time they were there, so they didn't get an opportunity to do that, right? Okay, let's do one more, and then we'll quit for tonight. Jane, would you take the last one, please?
Sorry. Jesus commended to Gannett much in the Greek philosophy and the Stoic doctrines, but he impressed upon the lad the truth that these systems of belief like the indefinite teachings of some of his own people, were religious only in the sense that they led men to find God and enjoy a living experience in knowing the eternal.
Okay, so the benefit was only that they you can find God and learn about God. Now, I want to make a point before we get off of Alexandria's this particular area is the fact that even back then, like today, which is an important point, the scientists were still not trying to meld science, philosophy, and religion into under one umbrella. Okay, they still kept everything separate, and that's still the way they're doing it today. We will never enjoy a total picture of reality and the universe until we meld religion, science, and philosophy all under the same thing. Okay, and that's very, very important because you can't have a good philosophy without the science. You can't have a good science without the religion and the concept of God because they're inseparable. They're all under the same concept of the I am or God the Father. That's just the way it is. You can't get around it no matter what you try to do. All right, and we're going to go into some little bit heavy stuff next time, the discourse on reality. So we'll take that up next time. Let me stop the share and bring up the prayer of acceptance. Okay, I haven't read it in a while. Letch, would you like to read it for us tonight?
Okay.
Yeah.
I believe that God is my paradise father, and that only by faith am I saved. No sacrifice is necessary. By this same faith, I became a child of God, and know that all men and women are my brothers and sisters. We know the Son of God, the sovereign of our universe of Nebadon, as Christ Michael, Jesus of Nazareth. By allowing the will of God to become my will, I will someday stand in the presence of the Paradise Father. In the name of Christ Michael, Jesus of Nazareth, amen.
Amen.
Amen. Amen.
Thank you all for joining us. Out there.
Thank you, Roger.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye, guys.
See everybody on Tuesday. Sunday, if you're going to come to the Sunday. One of the two. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Love you guys.
We love you too.
Good night.